26. School started, and so did our daily trips past the Radley place. Jim was in the 7th grade and went to high school beyond the grammar school building. I was now in the 3rd grade, and our routines were so different. I only walked to school with Jim in the mornings and saw him at mealtimes. He went out for football, but was too slender and too young yet to do anything but carry the team water buckets. This he did with enthusiasm. Most afternoons he was seldom home before dark. The Radley place had ceased to terrify me, but it was no less gloomy, no less chilly under its great oaks, and no less uninviting. Mr. Nathan Radley could still be seen on a clear day, walking to and from town. We knew Boo was there for the same old reason. Nobody'd seen him carried out yet. I sometimes felt a twinge of remorse when passing by the old place at ever having taken part in what must have been sheer torment to Arthur Radley. What reasonable recluse wants children peeping through his shutters, delivering greetings on the end of a fishing pole, wandering in his collards at night? And yet I remembered 2 Indian head pennies, chewing gum, soap dolls, a rusty medal, a broken watch and chain. Jim must have put them away somewhere. I stopped and looked at the tree one afternoon. The trunk was swelling around its cement patch. The patch itself was turning yellow. We had almost seen him a couple of times, a good enough score for anybody. But I still looked for him each time I went by. Maybe some day we would see him. I imagined how it would be. When it happened, he'd just be sitting in the swing when I came along. "Hi-de-do, Mr. Arthur," I would say, as if I had said it every afternoon of my life. "Evening, Jean Louise," he would say, as if he had said it every afternoon of my life. "Right pretty spell we're having, isn't it?" "Yes, sir, right pretty," I would say, and go on. It was only a fantasy. We would never see him. He probably did go out when the moon was down and gaze upon Miss Stephanie Crawford. I'd have picked somebody else to look at, but that was his business. He would never gaze at us. "You aren't starting that again, are you?" said Atticus one night, when I expressed a stray desire just to have one good look at Boo Radley before I died. "If you are, I'll tell you right now, stop it. I'm too old to go chasing you off the Radley property. Besides, it's dangerous. You might get shot. You know, Mr. Nathan shoots at every shadow he sees, even shadows that leave size 4 bare footprints. You were lucky not to be killed." I hushed then and there. At the same time, I marveled at Atticus. This was the first he had let us know he knew a lot more about something than we thought he knew, and it had happened years ago. No, only last summer. No, summer before last, when time was playing tricks on me. I must remember to ask Jim. So many things had happened to us. Boo Radley was the least of our fears. Atticus said he didn't see how anything else could happen, that things had a way of settling down, and after enough time passed, people would forget that Tom Robinson's existence was ever brought to their attention. Perhaps Atticus was right, but the events of the summer hung over us like smoke in a closed room. The adults in Macomb never discussed the case with Jim and me. It seemed that they discussed it with their children, and their attitude must have been that neither of us could help having Atticus for a parent, so their children must be nice to us in spite of him. The children would never have thought that up for themselves. Had our classmates been left to their own devices, Jim and I would have had several swift, satisfying fistfights apiece and ended the matter for good. as it was, we were compelled to hold our heads high and be, respectively, a gentleman and a lady. In a way, it was like the era of Mrs. Henry Lafayette DeBose without all her yelling. There was one odd thing, though, that I never understood. In spite of Atticus's shortcomings as a parent, people were content to re-elect him to the state legislature that year, as usual, without opposition. I came to the conclusion that people were just peculiar. I withdrew from them and never thought about them until I was forced to. I was forced to one day at school. Once a week, we had a current events period. Each child was supposed to clip an item from a newspaper, absorb its contents, and reveal them to the class. This practice allegedly overcame a variety of evils. Standing in front of his fellows encouraged good posture and gave a child poise. Delivering a short talk made him word conscious. Learning his current event strengthened his memory. Being singled out made him more than ever anxious to return to the group. The idea was profound, but as usual, in Macomb, it didn't work very well. In the first place, few rural children had access to newspapers, so the burden of current events was borne by the town children, convincing the bus children more deeply that the town children got all the attention anyway. The rural children who could usually brought clippings from what they called the grit paper, a publication spurious in the eyes of Miss Gates, our teacher. Why she frowned when a child recited from the grit paper, I never knew, but in some way it was associated with liking fiddling, eating syrupy biscuits for lunch, being a holy roller, singing Sweetly Sings the Donkey, and pronouncing it donkey, all of which the state paid teachers to discourage. Even so, not many of the children knew what a current event was. Little Chuck Little, 100 years old in his knowledge of cows and their habits, was halfway through an Uncle Natural story when Miss Gates stopped him. "Charles, that is not a current event. That is an advertisement." Cecil Jacobs knew what one was, though. When his turn came, he went to the front of the room and began, "Old Hitler, Adolf Hitler, Cecil," said Miss Gates, "one never begins with old anybody." "Yes, ma'am," he said. "Old Adolf Hitler has been persecuting Cecil." "No, Miss Gates, it says here." "Well, anyway, old Adolf Hitler has been after the Jews, and he's putting them in prisons, and he's taken away all their property, and he won't let any of them out of the country, and he's washing all the feeble-minded and..."
"Washing the feeble-minded?"
"Yes, ma'am, Miss Gates. I reckon they don't have sense enough to wash themselves. I don't reckon an idiot could keep himself clean. Well, anyway, Hitler started a program to round up all the half-Jews, too, and he wants to register 'em in case they might want to cause him any trouble, and I think this is a bad thing, and that's my current event." "Very good, Cecil," said Miss Gates. Puffing, Cecil returned to his seat. A hand went up in the back of the room. "How can he do that?"
"Who do what?" asked Miss Gates patiently.
"I mean, how can Hitler just put a lot of folks in a pen like that? Looks like the government 'd stop him," said the owner of the hand.
"Hitler is the government," said Miss Gates, and seizing an opportunity to make education dynamic, she went to the blackboard. She printed "Democracy" in large letters. "Democracy," she said. "Does anybody have a definition?"
"Us," somebody said. I raised my hand, remembering an old campaign slogan Atticus had once told me about.
"What do you think it means, Jean Louise?"
"Equal rights for all, special privileges for none," I quoted.
"Very good, Jean Louise, very good." Miss Gates smiled. In front of democracy, she printed, "We are A." Now, class, say it all together. We are a democracy.
We said it. Then Miss Gates said, "That's the difference between America and Germany. We are a democracy, and Germany is a dictatorship."
"Dictatorship," she said. "Over here, we don't believe in persecuting anybody. Persecution comes from people who are prejudiced."
"Prejudice," she enunciated carefully. "There are no better people in the world than the Jews, and why Hitler doesn't think so is a mystery to me."
An inquiring soul in the middle of the room said, "Why don't they like the Jews, you reckon, Miss Gates?"
"I don't know, Henry. They contribute to every society they live in, and most of all, they are a deeply religious people. Hitler's trying to do away with religion, so maybe he doesn't like them for that reason."
Cecil spoke up. "Well, I don't know for certain," he said. "They're supposed to change money or something, but that ain't no cause to persecute 'em. They're white, ain't they?"
Miss Gates said, "When you get to high school, Cecil, you'll learn that the Jews have been persecuted since the beginning of history, even driven out of their own country. It's one of the most terrible stories in history. Time for arithmetic, children."
As I had never liked arithmetic, I spent the period looking out the window. The only time I ever saw Atticus scowl was when Elmer Davis would give us the latest on Hitler. Atticus would snap off the radio and say, "Humph!" I asked him once why he was impatient with Hitler, and Atticus said, "Because he's a maniac."
This would not do, I mused, as the class proceeded with its sums. One maniac and millions of German folks. Looked to me like they'd shut Hitler in a pen instead of letting him shut them up. There was something else wrong. I would ask my father about it. I did, and he said he could not possibly answer my question because he didn't know the answer.
"But it's okay to hate Hitler?"
"It is not," he said. "It's not okay to hate anybody."
"Atticus," I said, "there's something I don't understand. Miss Gates said it was awful, Hitler doing like he does. She got real red in the face about it."
"I should think she would.
But..."
"Yes?"
"Nothing, sir."
I went away, not sure that I could explain to Atticus what was on my mind, not sure that I could clarify what was only a feeling. Perhaps Jim could provide the answer. Jim understood school things better than Atticus.
Jim was worn out from a day's water carrying. There were at least 12 banana peels on the floor by his bed, surrounding an empty milk bottle.
"What you stuffing for?" I asked.
"Coach says if I can gain 25 pounds by year after next, I can play," he said. "This is the quickest way. If you don't throw it all up."
"Jim," I said, "I want to ask you something."
"Shoot." He put down his book and stretched his legs.
"Miss Gates is a nice lady, ain't she?"
"Why, sure," said Jim. "I liked her when I was in her room."
"She hates Hitler a lot."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Well, she went on today about how bad it was, him treating the Jews like that. Jim, it's not right to persecute anybody, is it? I mean, have mean thoughts about anybody even, is it?"
"Gracious no, Scout. What's eating you?"
"Well, coming out of the courthouse that night, Miss Gates was... she was going down the steps in front of us. You must have not seen her. She was talking with Miss Stephanie Crawford. I heard her say it's time somebody taught them a lesson. They were getting way above themselves, and the next thing they think they can do is marry us. Jim,
How can you hate Hitler so bad and then turn around and be ugly about folks right at home?
Jim was suddenly furious. He leaped off the bed, grabbed me by the collar, and shook me.
I never want to hear about that courthouse again. Ever, ever. You hear me? You hear me? Don't you ever say one word to me about it again. You hear? Now go on.
I was too surprised to cry. I crept from Jim's room and shut the door softly, lest undue noise set him off again. Suddenly tired, I wanted Atticus. He was in the living room, and I went to him and tried to get in his lap. Atticus smiled.
You're getting so big now, I'll just have to hold a part of you.
He held me close. Scout, he said softly, don't let Jim get you down. He's having a rough time these days. I heard you back there.
Atticus said that Jim was trying hard to forget something, but what he was really doing was storing it away for a while until enough time passed. Then he would be able to think about it and sort things out. When he was able to think about it, Jim would be himself again.
27. Things did settle down, after a fashion, as Atticus said they would. By the middle of October, only two small things out of the ordinary happened to two Macomb citizens. No, there were three things, and they did not directly concern us, the Finches. But in a way they did. The first thing was that Mr. Bob Ewell acquired and lost a job in a matter of days, and probably made himself unique in the annals of the 1930s. He was the only man I ever heard of who was fired from the WPA for laziness. I suppose his brief burst of fame brought on a briefer burst of industry, but his job lasted only as long as his notoriety. Mr. Ewell found himself as forgotten as Tom Robinson. Thereafter, he resumed his regular weekly appearances at the welfare office for his check, and received it with no grace amid obscure mutterings that the bastards who thought they ran this town wouldn't permit an honest man to make a living. Ruth Jones, the welfare lady, said Mr. Ewell openly accused Atticus of getting his job. She was upset enough to walk down to Atticus's office and tell him about it. Atticus told Miss Ruth not to fret, that if Bob Ewell wanted to discuss Atticus's getting his job, he knew the way to the office. The second thing happened to Judge Taylor. Judge Taylor was not a Sunday night churchgoer. Mrs. Taylor was. Judge Taylor savored his Sunday night hour alone in his big house, and church time found him holed up in his study, reading the writings of Bob Taylor. No kin, but the judge would have been proud to claim it. One Sunday night, lost in fruity metaphors and florid diction, Judge Taylor's attention was wrenched from the page by an irritating scratching noise. "Hush," he said to Ann Taylor, his fat, nondescript dog. Then he realized he was speaking to an empty room. The scratching noise was coming from the rear of the house. Judge Taylor clumped to the back porch to let Ann out and found the screen door swinging open. A shadow on the corner of the house caught his eye, and that was all he saw of his visitor. Mrs. Taylor came home from church to find her husband in his chair, lost in the writings of Bob Taylor, with a shotgun across his lap. The third thing happened to Helen Robinson, Tom's widow. If Mr. Ewell was as forgotten as Tom Robinson was as forgotten as Boo Radley. But Tom was not forgotten by his employer, Mr. Link Dees. Mr. Link Dees made a job for Helen. He didn't really need her, but he said he felt right bad about the way things turned out.
I never knew who took care of her children while Helen was away. Calpurnia said it was hard on Helen because she had to walk nearly a mile out of her way to avoid the Yules, who, according to Helen, chunked at her the first time she tried to use the public road. Mr. Link Dees eventually received the impression that Helen was coming to work each morning from the wrong direction and dragged the reason out of her.
"Just let it be, Mr. Link, please, sir," Helen begged. "The hell I will," said Mr. Link. He told her to come by his store that afternoon before she left. She did, and Mr. Link closed his store, put his hat firmly on his head, and walked Helen home. He walked her the short way by the Yules. On his way back, Mr. Link stopped at the crazy gate.
"Yule," he called. "I say, Yule."
The windows, normally packed with children, were empty.
"I know every last one of you's in there laying on the floor. Now hear me, Bob Yule. If I hear one more peep out of my girl Helen about not being able to walk this road, I'll have you in jail before sundown."
Mr. Link spat in the dust and walked home. Helen went to work next morning and used the public road. Nobody chunked at her, but when she was a few yards beyond the Yule house, she looked around and saw Mr. Yule walking behind her. She turned and walked on, and Mr. Yule kept the same distance behind her until she reached Mr. Link Dee's house. All the way to the house, Helen said, she heard a soft voice behind her, crooning foul words. Thoroughly frightened, she telephoned Mr. Link at his store, which was not too far from his house. As Mr. Link came out of his store, he saw Mr. Yule leaning on the fence. Mr. Yule said, "Don't you look at me, Link Dees, like I was dirt. I ain't jumped yer. First thing you can do, Yule, is get your stinking carcass off my property. You're leaning on it, and I can't afford fresh paint for it. Second thing you can do is stay away from my cook, or I'll have you up for assault." "I ain't touched her, Link Dees, and ain't about to go with no nigger." "You don't have to touch her. All you have to do is make her afraid, and if assault ain't enough to keep you locked up a while, I'll get you in on the lady's law. So get out of my sight. If you don't think I mean it, just bother that girl again." Mr. Yule evidently thought he meant it, for Helen reported no further trouble. "I don't like it, Atticus. I don't like it at all," was Aunt Alexandra's assessment of these events. "That man seems to have a permanent running grudge against everybody connected with that case. I know how that kind are about paying off grudges, but I don't understand why he should harbor one. He had his way in court, didn't he?"
"I think I understand," said Atticus. "It might be because he knows in his heart that very few people in Macomb really believed his and Maella's yarns. He thought he'd be a hero, but all he got for his pain was, okay, we'll convict this Negro, but get back to your dump. He's had his fling with about everybody now, so he ought to be satisfied. He'll settle down when the weather changes."
"But why should he try to burgle John Taylor's house? He obviously didn't know John was home, or he wouldn't have tried. Only lights John shows on Sunday nights are on the front porch and back in his den. You don't know if Bob Yule cut that screen. You don't know who did it," said Atticus.
"But I can guess. I proved him a liar, but John made him look like a fool. All the time Yule was on the stand, I couldn't dare look at John and keep a straight face. John looked at him as if he were a three-legged chicken or a square egg. Don't tell me judges don't try to prejudice juries," Atticus chuckled.
By the end of October, our lives had become the familiar routine of school, play, study.
Jim seemed to have put out of his mind whatever it was he wanted to forget, and our classmates mercifully let us forget our father's eccentricities. Cecil Jacobs asked me one time if Atticus was a radical. When I asked Atticus, Atticus was so amused I was rather annoyed, but he said he wasn't laughing at me. He said, "You tell Cecil I'm about as radical as Cotton Tom Heflin." Aunt Alexandra was thriving. Miss Maudie must have silenced the whole missionary society at one blow, for Auntie again ruled that roost. Her refreshments grew even more delicious. I learned more about the poor Maroona's social life from listening to Mrs. Merriweather. They had so little sense of family that the whole tribe was one big family. A child had as many fathers as there were men in the community, as many mothers as there were women. J. Grimes Everett was doing his utmost to change this state of affairs and desperately needed our prayers.
Macomb was itself again. Precisely the same as last year and the year before that, with only two minor changes. Firstly, people had removed from their store windows and automobiles the stickers that said, "NRA, we do our part." I asked Atticus why, and he said it was because the National Recovery Act was dead. I asked who killed it. He said, 9 old men. The second change in Macomb since last year was not one of national significance. Until then, Halloween in Macomb was a completely unorganized affair. Each child did what he wanted to do, with assistance from other children if there was anything to be moved, such as placing a light buggy on top of the livery stable. But parents thought things went too far last year when the peace of Miss Tootie and Miss Fruity was shattered. Mrs. Tootie and Fruity Barber were maiden ladies, sisters, who lived together in the only Macomb residence boasting a cellar. The Barber ladies were rumored to be Republicans, having migrated from Clanton, Alabama, in 1911. Their ways were strange to us, and why they wanted a cellar, nobody knew. But they wanted one, and they dug one, and they spent the rest of their lives chasing generations of children out of it. Mrs. Tootie and Fruity, their names were Sarah and Frances, aside from their Yankee ways, were both deaf. Miss Tootie denied it and lived in a world of silence. But Miss Fruity, not about to miss anything, employed an ear trumpet so enormous that Jim declared it was a loudspeaker from one of those dog Victrolas. With these facts in mind and Halloween at hand, some wicked children had waited until the Misses Barber were thoroughly asleep, slipped into their living room, nobody but the Radleys locked up at night, stealthily made away with every stick of furniture therein, and hid it in the cellar. I deny having taken part in such a thing. "I heard 'em," was the cry that awoke the Mrs. Barber's neighbors at dawn next morning. "Heard 'em drive a truck up to the door, stomped around like horses. They're in New Orleans by now." Miss Tootie was sure those traveling fur sellers who came through town 2 days ago had purloined their furniture. "Dark they were," she said, "Syrians." Mr. Heck Tate was summoned. He surveyed the area and said he thought it was a local job. Miss Fruity said she'd know a Macomb voice anywhere, and there were no Macomb voices in that parlor last night. Rolling their R's all over her premises, they were. Nothing less than the bloodhounds must be used to locate their furniture, Miss Tootie insisted, so Mr. Tate was obliged to go 10 miles out the road, round up the county hounds, and put them on the trail. Mr. Tate started them off at the Mrs. Barber's front steps, but all they did was run around to the back of the house and howl at the cellar door. When Mr. Tate set them in motion 3 times,
he finally guessed the truth. By noontime that day, there was not a barefooted child to be seen in Macomb, and nobody took off his shoes until the hounds were returned. So the Macomb ladies said things would be different this year. The high school auditorium would be open. There would be a pageant for the grown-ups, apple bobbing, taffy pulling, pinning the tail on the donkey for the children. There would also be a prize of 25 cents for the best Halloween costume created by the wearer. Jim and I both groaned. Not that we'd ever done anything. It was the principle of the thing. Jim considered himself too old for Halloween anyway. He said he wouldn't be caught anywhere near the high school at something like that. Oh, well, I thought, Atticus would take me. I soon learned, however, that my services would be required on stage that evening. Mrs. Grace Merriweather had composed an original pageant entitled Macomb County, Ad Astra Per Aspera, and I was to be a ham. She thought it would be adorable if some of the children were costumed to represent the county's agricultural products. Cecil Jacobs would be dressed up to look like a cow. Agnes Boone would make a lovely butter bean. Another child would be a peanut. And on down the line until Mrs. Merriweather's imagination and the supply of children were exhausted. Our only duties, as far as I could gather from our two rehearsals, were to enter from stage left as Mrs. Merriweather, not only the author, but the narrator, identified us. When she called out, "Pork," that was my cue. Then the assembled company would sing, "Macomb County, Macomb County, we will aye be true to thee," as the grand finale, and Mrs. Merriweather would mount the stage with the state flag. My costume was not much of a problem. Mrs. Crenshaw, the local seamstress, had as much imagination as Mrs. Merriweather. Mrs. Crenshaw took some chicken wire and bent it into the shape of a cured ham. This she covered with brown cloth and painted it to resemble the original. I could duck under, and someone would pull the contraption down over my head. It came almost to my knees. Mrs. Crenshaw thoughtfully left two peepholes for me. She did a fine job. Jim said I looked exactly like a ham with legs. There were several discomforts, though. It was hot. It was a close fit. If my nose itched, I couldn't scratch. And once inside, I could not get out of it alone. When Halloween came, I assumed that the whole family would be present to watch me perform, but I was disappointed. Atticus said as tactfully as he could that he just didn't think he could stand a pageant tonight. He was all in. He had been in Montgomery for a week, and he had come home late that afternoon. He thought Jim might escort me if I asked him. Aunt Alexandra said she just had to get to bed early. She'd been decorating the stage all afternoon and was worn out. She stopped short in the middle of her sentence. She closed her mouth, then opened it to say something, but no words came. "What's the matter, Auntie?" I asked. "Oh, nothing, nothing," she said. "Somebody just walked over my grave." She put away from her whatever it was that gave her a pinprick of apprehension and suggested that I give the family a preview in the living room. So Jim squeezed me into my costume, stood at the living room door, called out, "Pork!" exactly as Mrs. Merriweather would have done, and I marched in. Atticus and Aunt Alexandra were delighted. I repeated my part for Calpurnia in the kitchen, and she said I was wonderful. I wanted to go across the street to show Miss Maudie, but Jim said she'd probably be at the pageant anyway. After that, it didn't matter whether they went or not.
Jim said he would take me. Thus began our longest journey together.
The weather was unusually warm for the last day of October. We didn't even need jackets. The wind was growing stronger, and Jim said it might be raining before we got home. There was no moon. The street light on the corner cast sharp shadows on the Radley house. I heard Jim laugh softly. "Bet nobody bothers them tonight," he said. Jim was carrying my ham costume rather awkwardly, as it was hard to hold. I thought it gallant of him to do so. "It is a scary place, though, ain't it?" I said. "Boo doesn't mean anybody any harm, but I'm right glad you're along. You know Atticus wouldn't let you go to the schoolhouse by yourself," Jim said. "Don't see why. It's just around the corner and across the yard. That yard's a mighty long place for little girls to cross at night," Jim teased. "Ain't you scared of haints?" We laughed. Haints. Hot steams, incantations, secret signs had vanished with our years as mist with sunrise. "What was that old thing?" Jim said. "Angel bright, life and death. Get off the road, don't suck my breath." "Cut it out now," I said. We were in front of the Radley place. Jim said, "Boo must not be at home. Listen." High above us in the darkness, a solitary mocker poured out his repertoire in blissful unawareness of whose tree he sat in, plunging from the shrill key-key of the sunflower bird to the irascible quack of the blue jay, to the sad lament of "Poor Will, poor Will, poor Will." We turned the corner, and I tripped on a root growing in the road. Jim tried to help me, but all he did was drop my costume in the dust. I didn't fall, though, and soon we were on our way again. We turned off the road and entered the schoolyard. It was pitch black. "How do you know where we're at, Jim?" I asked, when we had gone a few steps. "I can tell we're under the big oak because we're passing through a cool spot. Careful now, and don't fall again." We had slowed to a cautious gait and were feeling our way forward so as not to bump into the tree. The tree was a single and ancient oak. Two children could not reach around its trunk and touch hands. It was far away from teachers, their spies, and curious neighbors. It was near the Radley lot, but the Radleys were not curious. A small patch of earth beneath its branches was packed hard from many fights and furtive crap games. The lights in the high school auditorium were blazing in the distance, but they blinded us, if anything. "Don't look ahead, Scout," Jim said. "Look at the ground, and you won't fall." "You should have brought the flashlight, Jim." "Didn't know it was this dark."
"Didn't look like it'd be this dark earlier in the evening."
"So cloudy, that's why."
"It'll hold off a while, though."
Someone leaped at us.
"God Almighty!" Jim yelled. A circle of light burst in our faces, and Cecil Jacobs jumped in glee behind it.
"Ha, ha, ha! Gotcha!" he shrieked. "Thought you'd be coming along this way."
"What are you doing way out here by yourself, boy? Ain't you scared of Boo Radley?"
Cecil had ridden safely to the auditorium with his parents, hadn't seen us, then had ventured down this far because he knew good and well we'd be coming along. He thought Mr. Finch would be with us, though.
"Shucks, ain't much but around the corner," said Jim. "Who's scared to go around the corner?"
We had to admit that Cecil was pretty good, though. He had given us a fright, and he could tell it all over the schoolhouse. That was his privilege.
"Say," I said, "ain't you a cow tonight? Where's your costume?"
"It's up behind the stage," he said.
"Mrs. Merriweather says the pageant ain't coming on for a while. You can put yours back of the stage by mine, Scout, and we can go with the rest of 'em."
This was an excellent idea, Jim thought.
He also thought it was a good idea that Cecil and I would be together. This way, Jim would be left to go with people his own age. When we reached the auditorium, the whole town was there except Atticus and the ladies worn out from decorating, and the usual outcasts and shut-ins. Most of the county, it seemed, was there. The hall was teeming with slicked-up country people. The high school building had a wide downstairs hallway. People milled around booths that had been installed along each side. "Oh, Jim, I forgot my money," I sighed when I saw them. "Atticus didn't," Jim said. "Here's 30 cents. You can do 6 things. See you later on." "Okay," I said, quite content with 30 cents and Cecil. I went with Cecil down to the front of the auditorium, through a door on one side, and backstage. I got rid of my ham costume and departed in a hurry, for Mrs. Merriweather was standing at a lectern in front of the first row of seats, making last-minute, frenzied changes in the script. "How much money you got?" I asked Cecil. Cecil had 30 cents, too, which made us even. We squandered our first nickels on the House of Horrors, which scared us not at all. We entered the black seventh-grade room and were led around by the temporary ghoul in residence and were made to touch several objects alleged to be the component parts of a human being. "Here's his eyes," we were told when we touched 2 peeled grapes on a saucer. "Here's his heart, which felt like raw liver. These are his innards," and our hands were thrust into a plate of cold spaghetti. Cecil and I visited several booths. We each bought a sack of Mrs. Judge Taylor's homemade divinity. I wanted to bob for apples, but Cecil said it wasn't sanitary. His mother said he might catch something from everybody's heads having been in the same tub. "Ain't anything around town now to catch," I protested. But Cecil said his mother said it was unsanitary to eat after folks. I later asked Aunt Alexandra about this, and she said people who held such views were usually climbers. We were about to purchase a blob of taffy when Mrs. Merriweather's runners appeared and told us to go backstage. It was time to get ready. The auditorium was filling with people. The Macomb County High School band had assembled in front below the stage. The stage footlights were on, and the red velvet curtain rippled and billowed from the scurrying going on behind it. Backstage, Cecil and I found the narrow hallway teeming with people. Adults in homemade 3-corner hats, Confederate caps, Spanish-American war hats, and World War helmets. Children, dressed as various agricultural enterprises, crowded around the one small window. "Somebody smashed my costume!" I wailed in dismay. Mrs. Merriweather galloped to me, reshaped the chicken wire, and thrust me inside. "You all right in there, Scout?" asked Cecil. "You sound so far off, like you was on the other side of a hill." "You don't sound any nearer," I said. The band played the national anthem, and we heard the audience rise. Then the bass drum sounded. Mrs. Merriweather, stationed behind her lectern beside the band, said, "Macomb County, ad astra per aspera." The bass drum boomed again. "That means," said Mrs. Merriweather, translating for the rustic elements, "from the mud to the stars." She added, unnecessarily it seemed to me, "a pageant."
"Reckon they wouldn't know what it was if she didn't tell 'em," whispered Cecil, who was immediately shushed. "The whole town knows it," I breathed. "But the country folks have come in," Cecil said.
"Be quiet back there," a man's voice ordered, and we were silent. The bass drum went boom with every sentence Mrs. Merriweather uttered. She chanted mournfully about Macomb County being older than the state,
that it was part of the Mississippi and Alabama territories that the first white man to set foot in the virgin forests was the probate judge's great-grandfather, five times removed, who was never heard of again. Then came the fearless Colonel Makem, for whom the county was named. Andrew Jackson appointed him to a position of authority, and Colonel Makem's misplaced self-confidence and slender sense of direction brought disaster to all who rode with him in the Creek Indian Wars. Colonel Makem persevered in his efforts to make the region safe for democracy, but his first campaign was his last. His orders, relayed to him by a friendly Indian runner, were to move south. After consulting a tree to ascertain from its lichen which way was south, and taking no lip from the subordinates who ventured to correct him, Colonel Makem set out on a purposeful journey to rout the enemy and entangled his troops so far northwest in the forest primeval that they were eventually rescued by settlers moving inland. Mrs. Merriweather gave a 30-minute description of Colonel Makem's exploits. I discovered that if I bent my knees, I could tuck them under my costume and, more or less, sit. I sat down, listened to Mrs. Merriweather's drone and the bass drum's boom, and was soon fast asleep. They said later that Mrs. Merriweather was putting her all into the grand finale, that she had crooned "Pork" with a confidence born of pine trees and butter beans entering on cue. She waited a few seconds, then called, "Pork!" When nothing materialized, she yelled, "Pork!" I must have heard her in my sleep, or the band playing Dixie woke me, but it was when Mrs. Merriweather triumphantly mounted the stage with the state flag that I chose to make my entrance. "Chose" is incorrect. I thought I'd better catch up with the rest of them. They told me later that Judge Taylor went out behind the auditorium and stood there slapping his knees so hard, Mrs. Taylor brought him a glass of water and one of his pills. Mrs. Merriweather seemed to have a hit. Everybody was cheering so, but she caught me backstage and told me I had ruined her pageant. She made me feel awful, but when Jim came to fetch me, he was sympathetic. He said he couldn't see my costume much from where he was sitting. How he could tell I was feeling bad under my costume, I don't know, but he said I did all right. I just came in a little late, that was all. Jim was becoming almost as good as Atticus at making you feel right when things went wrong. Almost. Not even Jim could make me go through that crowd, and he consented to wait backstage with me until the audience left. "You want to take it off, Scout?" he asked. "Nah, I'll just keep it on," I said. I could hide my mortification under it. "You all want to ride home?" someone said. "No, sir, thank you," I heard Jim say. "It's just a little walk." "Be careful of Haints," the voice said. "Better still, tell the Haints to be careful of Scout." "There aren't any folks left now," Jim told me. "Let's go." We went through the auditorium to the hallway, then down the steps. It was still black dark. The remaining cars were parked on the other side of the building, and their headlights were little help. "If some of them were going in our direction, we could see better," said Jim. "Here, Scout, let me hold on to your hock. You might lose your balance." "I can see all right." "Yeah, but you might lose your balance." I felt a slight pressure on my head and assumed that Jim had grabbed that end of the ham. "You got me?" "Uh-huh." We began crossing the black schoolyard, straining to see our feet. "Jim," I said, "I forgot my shoes. They're back behind the stage." "Well, let's go get them." But as we turned around, The auditorium lights went off. "You can get 'em tomorrow," he said. "But tomorrow's Sunday," I protested as Jim turned me homeward. "You can get the janitor to let you in."
"Scout?"
"Hmm?" "Nothing." Jim hadn't started like that in a long time. I wondered what he was thinking. He'd tell me when he wanted to, probably when we got home. I felt his fingers press the top of my costume. Too hard, it seemed. I shook my head. "Jim, you don't have to..." "Hush a minute, Scout," he said, pinching me. We walked along silently. "Minute's up," I said. "What you thinking about?" I turned to look at him, but his outline was barely visible. "Thought I heard something," he said. "Stop a minute." We stopped.
"Hear anything?" he asked.
"No." We had not gone 5 paces before he made me stop again. "Jim, are you trying to scare me? You know I'm too old."
"Be quiet," he said,
and I knew he was not joking. The night was still. I could hear his breath coming easily beside me. Occasionally, there was a sudden breeze that hit my bare legs, but it was all that remained of a promised windy night. This was the stillness before a thunderstorm. We listened.
"Heard an old dog just then," I said.
"It's not that," Jim answered. "I hear it when we're walking along, but when we stop, I don't hear it. You hear my costume rustling. Oh, it's just Halloween got you." I said it more to convince myself than Jim, for sure enough, as we began walking, I heard what he was talking about. It was not my costume.
"It's just old Cecil," said Jim presently. "He won't get us again. Let's don't let him think we're hurrying."
We slowed to a crawl. I asked Jim how Cecil could follow us in this dark. Looked to me like he'd bump into us from behind.
"I can see you, Scout," Jim said.
"How?"
"I can't see you."
"Your fat streaks are showing. Mrs. Crenshaw painted them with some of that shiny stuff so they'd show up under the footlights. I can see you pretty well, and I expect Cecil can see you well enough to keep his distance."
I would show Cecil that we knew he was behind us and we were ready for him.
"Cecil Jacobs is a big wet hen," I yelled suddenly, turning around. We stopped. There was no acknowledgement save "hen" bouncing off the distant schoolhouse wall.
"I'll get him," said Jim. "Hey! Hey! Hey! Hey!" answered the schoolhouse wall.
It was unlike Cecil to hold out for so long. Once he pulled a joke, he'd repeat it time and again. We should have been leapt at already.
Jim signaled for me to stop again. He said softly, "Scout, can you take that thing off?"
"I think so, but I ain't got anything on under it much."
"I've got your dress here.
I can't get it on in the dark."
"Okay," he said.
"Never mind."
"Jim, are you afraid?"
"No. Think we're almost to the tree now. A few yards from that, and we'll be to the road. We can see the street light then."
Jim was talking in an unhurried, flat, toneless voice. I wondered how long he would try to keep the Cecil myth going.
"You reckon we ought to sing, Jim?"
"No. Be real quiet again, Scout." We had not increased our pace. Jim knew as well as I that it was difficult to walk fast without stumping a toe, tripping on stones, and other inconveniences, and I was barefooted. Maybe it was the wind rustling the trees, but there wasn't any wind, and there weren't any trees except the big oak. Our company shuffled and dragged his feet as if wearing heavy shoes. Whoever it was wore thick
cotton pants. What I thought were trees rustling was the soft swish of cotton on cotton, wheek, wheek, with every step. I felt the sand go cold under my feet, and I knew we were near the big oak. Jim pressed my head. We stopped and listened. Shufflefoot had not stopped with us this time. His trousers swished softly and steadily. Then they stopped. He was running, running toward us with no child's steps. "Run, Scout! Run! Run!" Jim screamed. I took one giant step and found myself reeling, my arms useless in the dark. I could not keep my balance. "Jim! Jim! Help me, Jim!" Something crushed the chicken wire around me. Metal ripped on metal, and I fell to the ground and rolled as far as I could, floundering to escape my wire prison. From somewhere nearby came scuffling, kicking sounds, sounds of shoes and flesh scraping dirt and roots. Someone rolled against me, and I felt Jim. He was up like lightning and pulling me with him, but though my head and shoulders were free, I was so entangled we didn't get very far. We were nearly to the road when I felt Jim's hand leave me, felt him jerk backwards to the ground. More scuffling, and there came a dull crunching sound, and Jim screamed. I ran in the direction of Jim's scream and sank into a flabby male stomach. Its owner said, "Hoof!" and tried to catch my arms, but they were tightly pinioned. His stomach was soft, but his arms were like steel. He slowly squeezed the breath out of me. I could not move. Suddenly he was jerked backwards and flung on the ground, almost carrying me with him. I thought, "Jim's up." One's mind works very slowly at times. Stunned, I stood there dumbly. The scuffling noises were dying. Someone wheezed, and the night was still again. Still, but for a man breathing heavily and staggering. I thought he went to the tree and leaned against it. He coughed violently, a sobbing, bone-shaking cough. "Jim?" There was no answer but the man's heavy breathing. "Jim?" Jim didn't answer. The man began moving around, as if searching for something. I heard him groan and pull something heavy along the ground. It was slowly coming to me that there were now four people under the tree. "Atticus?" The man was walking heavily and unsteadily toward the road. I went to where I thought he had been and felt frantically along the ground, reaching out with my toes. Presently, I touched someone. "Jim?" My toes touched trousers, a belt buckle, buttons, something I could not identify, a collar, and a face. A prickly stubble on the face told me it was not Jim's. I smelled stale whiskey. I made my way along in what I thought was the direction of the road. I was not sure because I had been turned around so many times, but I found it and looked down to the streetlight. A man was passing under it. The man was walking with the staccato steps of someone carrying a load too heavy for him. He was going around the corner. He was carrying Jim. Jim's arm was dangling crazily in front of him. By the time I reached the corner, the man was crossing our front yard. Light from our front door framed Atticus for an instant. He ran down the steps, and together he and the man took Jim inside. I was at the front door when they were going down the hall. Aunt Alexandra was running to meet me. "Call Dr. Reynolds,"
Atticus's voice came sharply from Jim's room. "Where's Scout?"
"Here she is," Aunt Alexandra called, pulling me along with her to the telephone. She tugged at me anxiously.
"I'm all right, Annie," I said. "You better call."
She pulled the receiver from the hook and said, "Eula May, get Dr. Reynolds, quick.
Agnes, is your father home?"
"Oh, God, where is he? Please tell him to come over here as soon as he comes in. Please, it's urgent."
There was no need for Aunt Alexandra to identify herself. People in Macomb knew each other's voices. Atticus came out of Jim's room. The moment Aunt Alexandra broke the connection, Atticus took the receiver from her. He rattled the hook, then said,
"Eula May, get me the sheriff, please."
"Heck, Atticus Finch. Someone's been after my children. Jim's hurt. Between here and the schoolhouse. I can't leave my boy. Run out there for me, please, and see if he's still around. Doubt if you'll find him now, but I'd like to see him if you do. Gotta go now. Thanks, Heck."
"Atticus, is Jim dead?"
"No, Scout. Look after her sister," he called as he went down the hall.
Aunt Alexandra's fingers trembled as she unwound the crushed fabric and wire from around me.
"Are you all right, darling?" she asked over and over as she worked me free.
It was a relief to be out. My arms were beginning to tingle, and they were red with small hexagonal marks. I rubbed them, and they felt better.
"Annie, is Jim dead?"
"No, no, darling. He's unconscious. We won't know how badly he's hurt until Dr. Reynolds gets here. Jean Louise, what happened?"
"I don't know."
She left it at that. She brought me something to put on, and had I thought about it then, I would have never let her forget it. In her distraction, Auntie brought me my overalls. "Put these on, darling," she said, handing me the garments she most despised. She rushed back to Jim's room, then came to me in the hall. She patted me vaguely and went back to Jim's room. A car stopped in front of the house. I knew Dr. Reynolds' step almost as well as my father's. He had brought Jim and me into the world, had led us through every childhood disease known to man, including the time Jim fell out of the treehouse, and he had never lost our friendship. Dr. Reynolds said if we had been boil-prone, things would have been different, but we doubted it. He came in the door and said, "Good Lord." He walked toward me and said, "You're still standing," and changed his course. He knew every room in the house. He also knew that if I was in bad shape, so was Jim. After 10 forevers, Dr. Reynolds returned.
"Is Jim dead?" I asked.
"Far from it," he said, squatting down to me. "He's got a bump on the head just like yours and a broken arm. Scout, look that way. No, don't turn your head. Roll your eyes. Now look over yonder. He's got a bad break. So far as I can tell now, it's in the elbow, like somebody tried to wring his arm off. Now look at me."
"Then he's not dead?"
"No." Dr. Reynolds got to his feet. "We can't do much tonight," he said, "except try to make him as comfortable as we can. We'll have to x-ray his arm. Looks like he'll be wearing his arm way out by his side for a while. Don't worry, though. He'll be as good as new. Boys his age bounce."
While he was talking, Dr. Reynolds had been looking keenly at me, lightly fingering the bump that was coming on my forehead.
"You don't feel broke anywhere, do you?"
Dr. Reynolds' small joke made me smile.
"Then you don't think he's dead, then?"
He put on his hat.
"Now, I may be wrong, of course,
but I think he's very alive. Shows all the symptoms of it. Go have a look at him, and when I come back, we'll get together and decide.
Dr. Reynolds' step was young and brisk. Mr. Heck Tate's was not. His heavy boots punished the porch, and he opened the door awkwardly. But he said the same thing Dr. Reynolds said when he came in.
"You all right, Scout?"
he added.
"Yes, sir. I'm going in to see Jim. Atticus and them's in there."
"I'll go with you," said Mr. Tate.
Aunt Alexandra had shaded Jim's reading light with a towel, and his room was dim. Jim was lying on his back. There was an ugly mark along one side of his face. His left arm lay out from his body. His elbow was bent slightly, but in the wrong direction. Jim was frowning.
"Jim?" Atticus spoke.
"He can't hear you, Scout. He's out like a light. He was coming around, but Dr. Reynolds put him out again."
"Yes, sir," I retreated. Jim's room was large and square. Aunt Alexandra was sitting in a rocking chair by the fireplace. The man who brought Jim in was standing in a corner, leaning against the wall. He was some countryman I did not know. He had probably been at the pageant and was in the vicinity when it happened. He must have heard our screams and come running. Atticus was standing by Jim's bed. Mr. Heck Tate stood in the doorway. His hat was in his hand, and a flashlight bulged from his pants pocket. He was in his working clothes.
"Come in, Heck," said Atticus. "Did you find anything? I can't conceive of anyone low down enough to do a thing like this, but I hope you found him."
Mr. Tate sniffed. He glanced sharply at the man in the corner, nodded to him, then looked around the room, at Jim, at Aunt Alexandra, then at Atticus.
"Sit down, Mr. Finch," he said pleasantly. Atticus said, "Let's all sit down. Have that chair, Heck. I'll get another one from the living room."
Mr. Tate sat in Jim's desk chair. He waited until Atticus returned and settled himself. I wondered why Atticus had not brought a chair for the man in the corner, but Atticus knew the ways of country people far better than I. Some of his rural clients would park their long-eared steeds under the chinaberry trees in the backyard, and Atticus would often keep appointments on the back steps. This one was probably more comfortable where he was.
"Mr. Finch," said Mr. Tate, "tell you what I found. I found a little girl's dress. It's out there in my car."
"That your dress, Scout?"
"Yes, sir. It's a pink one with smocking," I said. Mr. Tate was behaving as if he were on the witness stand. He liked to tell things his own way, untrammeled by state or defense, and sometimes it took him a while. "I found some funny-looking pieces of muddy-colored cloth."
"That's my costume, Mr. Tate."
Mr. Tate ran his hands down his thighs. He rubbed his left arm and investigated Jim's mantelpiece. Then he seemed to be interested in the fireplace. His fingers sought his long nose.
"What is it, Heck?" said Atticus.
Mr. Tate found his neck and rubbed it. "Bob Ewell's lying on the ground under that tree down yonder, with a kitchen knife stuck up under his ribs. He's dead, Mr. Finch."